Getting ready to hike the Appalachian Trail, all 2,180 miles of it. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy estimates that about 12,000 people have thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail since 1937. Most start in the spring at the southern trailhead on Springer Mountain in Georgia. Only about 1 in 4 who start out will make it the entire way. The final stretch, the Appalachian Trail in Maine, ending at Mount Katahdin, is known to be the very toughest part of the trail. Among those setting off in about 2 weeks will be two young men from Maine who will be chronicling their journey for the rest of us to follow. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll meet Dan and Danny, and we'll learn about the hike from someone who's made it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Appalachian Trail is the longest hiking-only footpath in the world. It covers 2,000-plus miles and goes through 14 states. Each year, intrepid hikers take on this challenge. Some make it, many do not, but almost everyone who experiences even a part of the trail says it's a profound experience. Well, today I'm joined by two hikers who are about to embark on this journey. We will also hear from hikers, experienced hikers who know the trail intimately and who have been instrumental in conserving Maine's stretch of the AT. In the studio with me, Danny Moody. He is a sales consultant at Charlie's Chevrolet in Winthrop. He's also a whitewater rafting guide. Dan Jaguer is an outdoorsman from Manchester, Maine. Did I pronounce your name right, Dan?
You did.
Oh, excellent. Danny and Dan are the two hikers selected by Maine Public to take the rest of us on a journey. They will be using the Maine Public app to document their trip. And Tony Barrett's here, too. He served as vice president of the Maine Appalachian Trail Club and is an executive committee member. He has thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail and has been maintaining a section of the trail in Maine for 17 years. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever hiked the Appalachian Trail or dreamed of doing so? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Tony, what do these guys have in store?
Oh, they have the experience of a lifetime. My hike on the Appalachian Trail is probably the most memorable thing I've done in my life other than getting married. So,
and you did it in 1999?
1999.
What was the reason you did it? Do you remember what you were thinking at the time?
It was probably the challenge, and that's the reason for a lot of people. When I was a young boy, as a Boy Scout, we went out and worked on the Appalachian Trail, and it kind of planted the seed. And I always had that in the back of my mind, and I never stepped back on the Appalachian Trail until the first day that I started my thru hike 30 years later. So it was already always there, kind of growing.
And wait, you never stepped back, so you did it.
I did it.
But then you didn't go back.
Well, as a young boy, as a Boy Scout, I was on the Appalachian Trail.
I see.
But I never went back to the trail until I was 45 years old.
Wow, and that's a little older for a hiker on the trail, isn't it?
It is, but you know, age isn't that much of a determinant. We've had people as old as 86 years old finish the trail. Earl Schaefer, who did the trail the first time, did it a second time when he was 80. The first woman to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail, Emma Gatewood, did it when she was 67 years old. So,
fantastic. Some good strong knees in that group. Dan and Danny, have you always been thinking about doing this, or did the advertisements, the publicity for our project at Maine Public get you talking? Where'd this all come from?
Actually, my story kind of starts off a lot like his did. I was in the Boy Scouts when I was younger, and we worked on trails, and I always saw the AT as this huge, fascinating challenge. And it was always, like he said, in the back of my mind, and I always did all kinds of hiking, so I never thought, like, am I really going to do this? But then I met Danny Moody here, and he said he wanted to go, and it kind of gave me the courage and the opportunity to say, let's do this.
Danny, have you always wanted to do it as well?
For me, it probably came up about 2 years ago. I was working the same job I'm working right now. And I saw like an article on it. I think there was somebody on Facebook I saw that was hiking it, and And I already had kind of a love for the outdoors, and I saw it as a good opportunity for me being, you know, 22, not too many responsibilities. I figured if I was going to do it, I had to do it now. So that's when I kind of started the planning. And then it probably took about a year for me to kind of make all the plans set in stone and guarantee that I was going to be doing it.
What have you been doing to prepare?
Hiking. I've actually looked up. I've been trying to find, like, you Google how to plan for a through hike, how to train for a through hike. But all of them say, you know, the best way to train is just go out and just hike as much as you can, because there's really no way to replicate the terrain and the training in the gym. So you just got to kind of get out there and do it.
And what about you, Dan?
Well, I mean, it's tough to get out and hike a lot in the winter, especially I worked solid five days a week. There was no time to get out. I mean, I'd make it to the gym and I'd stay in shape. But like he said, it's really hard to replicate the same things. I mean, in the summer, you have time to get out and go hiking for a night or two. It's tough in the winter. So really just trying to stay in shape in the gym and just get outside once in a while and stay used to walking on rough terrain, because that's a big part of it.
So physically, what can they expect, Tony?
Both of them look like they're in fine shape. And like a lot of hikers, we have busy lives. And so you don't have a lot of time to go out and do a lot of conditioning. But once you get out on the trail, after about 2 weeks, you'll be pretty conditioned and fine-tuned, and I'm sure they'll do fine.
So I understand almost everybody who hikes the trail, who thru-hikes the trail or attempts it, has a trail name. What was your trail name?
I didn't take a trail name, and other hikers called me only Tony, because that's how I would respond to that question.
Have you all thought about what it will be, or do you know what it will just happen to you?
I've thought about giving ourselves trail names just so we don't get stuck with bad ones, but that kind of goes against, you know, the purpose of it, because a lot of people get their trail name from, you know, you make a mistake or you do something on the trail and then that's where your trail name will come up from. So we've been just kind of sticking with our regular names for right now, and I'm sure once we get out there we'll find some trail names.
Yeah, especially with if people start noticing us as the two boys connected with the MPBN and like trying to talk to people, I'm sure we'll all of a sudden everyone will start recognizing us on the trail and we'll get our own trail names.
Tony, how would you describe the experience? I've heard it described as a profound experience, a spiritual experience. Was it that for you?
Initially, I was expecting a challenge and, you know, it being a tough, long walk. But after I got into it, I discovered a side of myself where I came to appreciate nature, and I started slowing down and started contemplating just being out in the woods. So I think it opened my eyes to kind of a more natural appreciation for the outdoors than I had before.
So in the beginning, you were seeing how many miles you could cover each day, and
yeah, I was
that
looking
became
at it as
less
kind of
important.
The challenge, and you know, I'm out here just to walk. But after you're out there and you experience not only the nature but the cultural side of the trail, it's pretty interesting.
And you've maintained your dedication to it by maintaining a stretch of the trail for 17 years. Why don't you tell us about what that entails? How long is the stretch of trail that you maintain? What does that mean? I'm guessing it means that you're going in with a chainsaw if something has fallen over the trail, and you're trying to make sure there isn't a place where people are going to twist their ankle because there's suddenly a big, do you call it a pothole on the Appalachian Trail?
Well, I want to make sure people like Dan and Danny can traverse the trail safely. And our organization here in Maine maintains almost the entire section of the Appalachian Trail. And it's keeping the trail clear, blowdowns, making it safe. But we do more than that. We're actually through a cooperative management agreement with the National Park Service. We're delegated responsibilities not only for maintaining the trail but actually managing the trail here in the state of Maine for the National Park Service.
How many days of the week are you on the trail, or of the month in the summertime?
Not as many as I'd like, but I try to get up there probably 2 or 3 days in the spring for winter cleanup, and then a couple times during the summer and fall.
So Dan and Danny, you all are chronicling this for Maine Public. You're going to be using the app. You're going to have a satellite phone. What are we going to learn from you? What do you plan to share with the rest of us, and what do you plan to maybe not share with the rest of us?
It's tough to say right now, you know what I mean, being that we haven't even started the trip, because I'm sure that once you get walking, you'll start thinking of more and more you want to say. So I'm sure that once we're out there and and kind of documenting the trip that we'll start coming out with things that we didn't maybe plan on saying or things we hadn't thought about before we had started the trip.
Yeah, and a big piece of what we want to share is like what other through hikers are thinking or like what's going on in our daily lives, because people are going to be wondering, I see the weather was bad down there this week. I wonder how their week was. And we've spent the whole week in the rain or something, and I'm sure that's something people would find interesting. And we're really using a big part of the app is so we can sort of stay connected with Maine and what's going on back at home.
Yeah, I understand your parents are pretty happy that you're going to be connected.
Yes, very.
Yeah.
So what was I going to say? What kind of response have you received from people you know when you've told them that you're doing this? Not only that you're going to try to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail, but also that you're going to take part in this Maine Public project where you're doing this, you know, kind of taking us all on this vicarious journey with you.
I mean, most people we tell are all enthusiastic about us going on the trail. And then when we bring up the whole thing about being sponsored by MPBN and like all this TV shows and talking on the radio we've been doing, most people can't believe it that us two Maine boys are out here doing all this. But we're pretty excited and everyone's right there with us, hoping we do good and can finish everything.
All right. Tony, I know that when I was a kid, there was a lot of concern about, is the Appalachian Trail being overused? Is it going to become too popular? That doesn't seem to have happened, has it?
Yeah, the old notion, are we loving it to death? And even although we hear about increasing numbers, and they certainly have been increasing, there are still lots of places for solitude and to have a primitive wilderness hiking experience. It's where people come together, mainly at campsites, do we see overcrowding. And so as managers of the trail, we've been working on trying to get people to spread themselves out more. There's a volunteer registration to allow people like Danny and Dan to go on and see, well, when's a busy day when a lot of people are starting and when's a not-so-busy day? We try to help manage group use on the trail so that when the summer orientation trips for Bowdoin Bates and Bowdoin College take off, that they're not all at the same campsite at the same night.
And I understand there are folks who hike the entire trail like Dan and Danny are trying to, you know, taking time off work and taking off a summer, a spring to fall in their life to do it. But there are also people who do it in little stretches, who take a week vacation every year and start where they left off. How many people do that? Do we keep track of that?
Well, we call them section hikers.
Section hikers.
And it's probably the toughest way to do the trail because every time you start a two-week stint, you have to get your legs back in shape. Whereas Danny and Dan, once they get in shape, they'll be cruising, so it's a lot easier. But we don't know the breakdown necessarily between total number of thru-hikers and section hikers. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy keeps track of what they call 2,000-milers, so you could take 10 years to finish or 1 year to finish. And that number has been steadily increasing. There's been probably about 2,800, 2,000-milers this past year.
Mm. So I read that you all will have to eat 5,500 calories a day to maintain your weight. What kind of food are you planning to take?
I don't think there's any type of specific food. It's going to probably be a lot of, like, calories, trying to get as many calories in your body as possible, pastas, rice. I mean, the main thing is something that won't go bad. A lot of freeze-dried stuff. You know, you open up the bag, add boiled water, close it up, and it just kind of brings it back to life. So those types of foods are probably primarily what we'll be eating.
Dried fruits and such like that, trail mix, things you can, especially during the day when we're hiking, we don't want to have to stop and make something, so it's going to be things you can eat as you go because you really want to spread your food throughout the day so you don't get tired or eat too much. So as long as you're steadily snacking on something that's giving you good energy.
Did you have a favorite? Did you have something that you survived on, Tony?
Yeah, it was red beans and rice.
Red beans and rice. Okay, yeah, so we'll favorite. Keep that in mind. And you all know each other already, right? You already know that you like each other and this is probably going to work out just fine.
Yeah, we actually just recently got done living together just because I was coming close to my trip. I moved all my stuff out. But we've been living together for about the past month, past year. And that's been kind of a good test to see how we do together for extended periods of time. And it was pretty good.
Yeah, and I think if we do run into a problem on the trail, you have one of us can leave an hour early and we can take a day off from each other and, you know, kind of cool down or take some time off if we get annoyed with the other person, but we're going to want each other there to keep us motivated and support.
Do you have anything you're most looking forward to, any place that you just can't wait to see?
For me, it's pretty much – I've never really done much hiking south of New England, so everything down there is going to be a completely new scene, and I can't wait.
I'm pretty excited to go through the Smoky Mountains. It's I've done a lot of kind of research on that, and it's a lot more mountainous. I mean, people think Tennessee, and they think it's flat, but, I mean, you look at like a raised relief type map, and it's just as mountainous as kind of the western Maine and northern New Hampshire type regions.
Did you have a favorite place, Tony?
I mean, all the states have unique and interesting sections of the trail. I think what southern New England and Maine and Connecticut, Massachusetts and Connecticut was probably fit my expectation of a walk in the woods. Certainly when I got to Maine, it was the toughest section of the trail.
I've heard that. Yes. I've heard that even folks who know mentally, even thru-hikers who know mentally that Maine is the toughest, they can't believe how tough it is.
Yeah. But it's really the most memorable of my experiences on the trail. I mean, you really get the sense of being in a wilderness, even though we know it's a working forest and that, you know, we're crossing logging roads. But you really have that perception of being out in the woods.
Okay. You guys excited? Nervous?
I'd say like the past year, it's been just pure excitement. And then you kind of come down to like, you know, we're leaving in 2 weeks. So it's kind of like your excitement kind of transitions over into more of like an anxious type excitement. But overall, definitely both excited.
Yeah, and definitely with being done work now, I'm ready to kind of get enough sitting around and get out there and get going. So I'm pretty anxious.
Enough sitting around. Well, our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Dean Wealth Advisors, an independently owned wealth management firm providing investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions. Information at DEIGHAN.com. And Hurricane Island Center for Science and Leadership, adult programs in wilderness medical training, permaculture, and bird banding. HurricaneIsland.net.
On the next Fresh Air, movie monsters and real monsters. Emil Ferris talks about her acclaimed graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters, about a girl who thinks of herself as a werewolf. Ferris started the book after she was infected by a mosquito bite that left her legs paralyzed and her hands barely able to move. She's recovered some movement and strength and retaught herself to draw. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. Do you love and appreciate public broadcasting? Well, then lend your voice in support of this valued service. Participate in our I Love Maine Public testimonial campaign. It's designed to raise awareness of what Maine Public means to Maine and its citizens. You can be a big part of this initiative, and all it takes is a minute of your time. We have an I Love Maine Public hotline, photo opportunities, and a written and verbal testimonial vault. There are any number of fun ways for you to join in. Please go to mainepublic.org to see all the ways you can participate. And thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, taking on the Appalachian Trail. With me in the studio, Tony Barrett, who is with the Maine Appalachian Trail Club. Danny Moody and Dan Jaguar, two hikers selected by Maine Public to document their through hike of the Appalachian Trail. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now on the line is David Field. He has held a multitude of positions with the Maine Appalachian Trail Club and the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. He is an author and former chair of the Forestry Department at the University of Maine in Orono. David, it's so nice to speak with you again. I think the last time was 8 years ago.
That's right, on top of Saddleback Junior, Jennifer. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What a wonderful day that was. And I know a little bit about this, but I suspect some of our listeners don't. You helped redraw the Appalachian Trail in Maine. What was wrong with it in the beginning, and what kind of goals did you have to make it what it is today?
When the trail was originally located through Maine in the early 30s, they really didn't have the time or the resources to pick what might have been the best routes. They also were very worried about how to maintain it, and so they picked fire warden trails and old logging roads that they thought would be maintained by other people, you know, and we wouldn't have to worry about that. It was not a good location, and when the National Trail Systems Act was passed in 1968, Maine Appalachian Trail Club Executive Committee sat down and said, gee, where would this trail have been if they'd had more time and resources? And we started drawing lines and ended up with, more than half of the trail originally was on logging roads. We ended up relocating over 170 miles of the trail in Maine, much more than half of it. And it's in pretty good location now.
And lots of incredible views now.
Oh, yeah. And no roadwalks anymore.
Can you share some interesting facts that people might not know about the Appalachian Trail in Maine?
Oh, dear. Even though we take a lot of pride, and Tony mentioned this, in the volunteer stewardship of the trail in Maine, it didn't start off that way. The original trail was built primarily by the Civilian Conservation Corps. And even up until about 1950, they were still paying people to maintain the trail. It wasn't until about 1950 that the volunteer effort really took over. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's a huge volunteer effort now.
What do you hope that future generations will appreciate about the trail?
Oh, I hope they'll appreciate what all the volunteers have done to make this treasure available. And I hope, and this has been mentioned before, this loving the trail to death business, it's increasingly used. It's fragile. Don't run on the trail. It damages the footpath. Leave no trace. Future generations are just going to have to appreciate what they have and then take as good care of it as they can.
David, are you still maintaining part of the trail?
I maintained a section over in western Maine for nearly 60 years.
60 years, wow.
60, yeah. Unfortunately, I'm getting old. I developed a little heart trouble last spring, so I gave up my section, but I'm still out working on the trail.
I think 60 years is a pretty good commitment. What advice do you have for our two young hikers here in the studio as they set off on their journey? What words of wisdom would you like to leave them with?
As Tony has already told them, Maine is tough, and they need to anticipate that. But I hope also northbounders tend, when they get to Maine, to really start to worry about finishing, and so they skip. They don't stop to smell the roses. We have some wonderful side trails that many northbounders just ignore. Say, take the side trails. And, you know, again, don't run. I would hope that by the time they get here, they may have learned the importance of things like paper maps as opposed to simply electronic. I teach a boating safety course, and I really preach to the students that, yes, the GPS and the chart plotters are great, but if you don't know how to use the paper maps and carry them with you, bad things can happen. Things can happen to disturb satellite reception. Your batteries can go dead. So I would encourage them to use paper maps as much as possible, as well as the great garments, which I use myself.
Well, thank you so much. David Field is an author, a vital conservation force for the Maine Appalachian Trail, and the former chair of forestry at UMaine Orono. So nice to hear from you, David.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And we'll go to some other calls now. We'll start with Greg, who's calling from Kennebunkport. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're in Maine calling. Let's see here. I'm going to try to do so. We have a new phone system here. It's been going pretty well. Greg, go ahead. Well, while I try to get Greg on the line, I will ask you, Tony, to tell us about David. He's really pretty much a legend, isn't he?
He is, and he has he's really the father of our club, and what a huge resource of knowledge and information.
I think we have Greg now. Greg and Kennebunk, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Hi, Jennifer. How you doing?
Great. You sound kind of distant. Are you on a speakerphone by chance?
Is that better?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Terrific. So anyway, I have an unusual anecdote about the Appalachian Trail and the rite of passage. When I was teaching at Fairleigh Dickinson University in Madison, New Jersey, one of my students was graduating. And as a rite of passage, he was planning on hiking the Appalachian Trail. So after he graduated, he took off his cap and gown. He rented a tuxedo, drove to New York City with his girlfriend, attended a performance of a chorus line, drove home, shaved his head and his mustache and beard, put on his backpack, and set out on the highway, hitchhiking up to the start of the Appalachian Trail in Maine. I and a friend of mine documented this whole journey with photographs. Unfortunately, before he got to the end of the trail in Maine, he was undone by insects. So I was wondering, if you're planning on doing the trail and you want to avoid that little mishap, is there a better time of year to start the journey?
Greg, now, did you say your student started in Maine and headed south?
Yes.
That's not the norm, is it, Tony?
It isn't. And if you're going to start in June or in late May when Baxter State Park opens, as many of us here in Maine know, that's black fly season. And you might want to adjust your timing a little bit to start later. If you're going to be doing a southbound through hike.
Well, can people do a southbound through hike if you start, say, in July? Will you end up in Georgia in, November?
Yeah, it might be a little tight. So most southbounders start in June.
Okay.
And, they probably have a little bit higher mosquito conflict during that month. But, Dan, probably part of the reason why Dan and Danny are starting south and walking with spring.
Yeah, and you guys are both fair, which I know because I'm fair, is we're mosquito magnets. So what are you taking with you for that?
I mean, I'm sure I'll just have some regular DEET and bug spray and maybe a net, but I think a big part of it is you kind of need to get used to what you can and wear long sleeves and pants if you can withstand the heat down there. But really, like weather-wise and bug-wise, it's kind of something we're just – that's going to be one of the challenges we have to deal with.
We have a tweet, and I hope I'm pronouncing this properly. The Pema Jawasset Loop in New Hampshire is a great training hike for prep, for Appalachian Trail prep. Summits Mount Lafayette and is something like 30 miles. Does that sound about right, Tony? Do you know that? Yeah?
It does, yeah.
You guys know that?
I'm not as familiar with the White Mountains as I am Maine.
And we have another tweet from Susan. How do you plan to celebrate completion? There was a problem recently when some thought too many people were on the top of the mountain. Do you have an idea of what you're going to do? And I'm going to say when, not if, when you reach the peak of Mount Katahdin?
I'm assuming what it'll probably be is everybody will probably meet in maybe a parking lot at Baxter or something like that. Everybody can celebrate. And then, it'll only take, a select few with us to the top. Because we really can't be walking up there with the herd, because especially with as many people have been saying, I'm going to hike Katahdin with you at the end. It's a large number, so we'll probably have to just wean through them in the parking lot and then take a select few up.
Yeah, and Baxter has come out since then and really frowned upon large groups going up the mountain. You can't really have, especially any sort of celebration up on top, they would really frown upon it. So it may be something maybe we meet everyone in Monson before you begin the 100-mile wilderness, or like he said, in the parking lot up in Katahdin.
I'm going to go to Bangor and Larry. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Back in the Jurassic period, I was a little boy, and we were taking a trip to Washington, and I got into the Smokies, and I found this trail, and I started walking it, and my mother found me at the next way station and was quite upset with me. But that's a long time ago. Since then, I've had 3 knee replacements. As you know, I only have 2 knees. So I'm wondering, I guess the maintainers would know the best, is there a portion of the main trail wherein someone who is somewhat limited like myself can go? I love the wilderness, but I'm over 70, so it's kind of hard to get there.
Tony, do you have thoughts on where Larry can hike the trail or a stretch of the trail?
Yeah, there's a section between the Kennebec River and the Bigelows that in part follows where the Benedict Arnold expedition followed. So through the Caring Place and the Caring Ponds are relatively, I'm not going to say, it's relative.
Relatively benign for the Appalachian Trail of Maine. And when you say Caring, C-A-R-R-Y-I-N-G,
that's
place
correct.
And yeah. Caring Ponds. There you go, Larry. Have fun. We're going to go also to Bangor and Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hi. I've got a couple questions for Tony, Dan, and Danny. Tony, if someone were to take off on the trail and not be sponsored, I mean, would they take a combination of credit cards and cash? I mean, while you're out there, what's, you know, where do you buy provisions and what's the easiest way, the best currency to do so?
Yeah. The majority of hikers are not sponsored, and most of your money before a trip is spent on equipment and getting your gear together. But once you start hiking, your number one expenditure is food. And the kind of rule of thumb is to plan on about $1,000 a month. You can do it a lot more frugally. I've seen hikers who carry their fishing poles with them and actually forage along the way, but that's not recommended because you'd probably go hungry fast. But there's plenty of places to stop and resupply and do it at a reasonable cost if you're budget constrained.
And the places where you can stop are hiked with the are stocked with the kind of foods that the hikers need.
That's right.
Okay. Jamie.
Dan, Danny, I got a couple real quick questions. How many pairs of boots do you think you're going to go through on this?
It'll probably be about a set of boots every 500 miles, obviously give or take. You know, once you start getting up to Maine and New Hampshire, it's a little bit rougher terrain and the center being a little bit flatter. But I'd say give or take about one every 500 miles.
Neat. I got one quick last question.
Absolutely.
How far do you expect it to go each day?
That will rely mostly on, you know, the geographical type terrain that we're going to be going over. So if we're going to be doing a lot of mountains and stuff like that, you know, maybe a little bit smaller day, you get towards the center, it flattens right out. You can really kind of pound the miles, just kind of do 20 miles a day, you know, and then obviously as you get up towards northern, the northern part, you'll probably, go down to, you know, 10, 12, 15 miles a day.
Well, great. Have fun and take the time to look around and enjoy.
Thank you.
Jamie, thanks so much for calling. The day that I spent with David Field in 2009 doing an interview for television with him, we ran into a thru-hiker who said that he had made 22 miles a day in New Hampshire, and then when he hit Maine, he was making about 8 miles a day. So there's sort of an example of the difference in difficulty from just one state to the next and from New Hampshire to Maine. I understand you all are not going, just the two of you. You've got a third member of your party.
Yeah, the third member is... my dog Daisy, she'll be tagging along.
What kind of dog?
She's a pit bull mix.
And is she a hiker?
She's an avid hiker, actually. She's pretty unbelievable on the mountain. That was this summer was kind of my deciding. I knew I was doing the trip. I had the offer to my mother said that she would keep her for the whole duration of the trip, and I kind of used this summer to gauge it. And I mean, we'd do a 15-mile day over three peaks, and I'd stop to take a break, and she's rolling around and running around and absolutely loving it. So that was kind of the biggest hike we did. After that, I was like, all right, she's ready, ready to go.
But that means you've got to pack dog food, too.
Yep,
or is
so
she going to carry
she's,
her own?
She's got her own pack. So it's a little pack. It's got little pouches on both sides. I'll probably start her off light. Get her acclimated to kind of doing the everyday walk. And then, I mean, at max, she'll probably be 5 pounds, I think it was, because I'm only going to make her carry her food. I got a little thermal sleeping pad for her and a blanket that I'm going to carry. So all she's really got to worry about is food and then maybe some snacks or something like that.
And we have some pictures. She's wicked cute. We're going to go to Denmark and Dave. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Great.
All right, excellent. I just wanted to share a couple of notes and things. I was an infantryman for 10 years in the United States Army. I did multiple combat tours. I've done a lot of long-distance trekking and things through training events and stuff like that. And I just wanted to throw out the idea, make sure you guys, I can't understate the value of mental and physical toughening. There's going to be days where you're going to roll out of your bag and be like, dude, not today. You're just going to have that day. But when it comes, just... you got to find a way to knuckle down and just dig deep and keep going. That was one of one of the big things, even if it's something simple like lickies and chewies, like I like gummy bears, gummy worms, because like as a typical infantry task, you'll walk 12 miles, you'll have a 3-hour time limit, and you're hauling 40 pounds of gear and crap. Another trek that I've done is I did through Special Forces selection a 36-mile trek with a 70-pound bag. It was incredibly tough. The second part is making sure you take care of your feet. And one of the just an infantry trick I thought I would share with you, two things. Number one, I can't understate the importance of pantyhose. And you might think it's funny, but it reduces friction. The other one is when you have blisters, which are inevitable, I highly recommend a needle and thread, pierce it through, and then tie it off. So then it toughens into a callus so much faster. And to be honest, that's the only reason I made it through 30 days of Special Forces selection.
Wow. When you say pantyhose, do you mean knee highs or putting them on the kind that go all the way up?
Well, to be honest with you, that depends on the individual. Now, you see, I've always been a stocky guy. Like, fighting weight for me was about 220 pounds. I'm not small. So I got stuff that went all the way up to my waist because you start talking about chafing around the legs and into, you know, your groin area. That's not fun. And after once it's raw, it's raw. There's very little you can do.
Well, thanks for your tips. Really interesting. And have you guys heard that one before?
I haven't heard that one yet. If I'm going to go with that method, I'll probably go with something that maybe cuts off before the knee, because I'll definitely be wearing short shorts.
I'll just add on. It's great to hear from a vet. There is a program called Walking Off the War, where veterans actually use the Appalachian Trail, walk on the Appalachian Trail to kind of reassimilate back to society and overcome some of their mental issues that they've faced. So,
I'm going to ask you, Tony, if you could post some information about that on our Maine Calling mm-hmm. Facebook page after the program. Thanks so much. And thanks for calling in, Dave. We do have to take another break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, along with Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
For years, few people believed these men were innocent, so they stayed locked up. Now, exonerated prisoners paired with famous crime writers tell their stories.
It's not a fantasy. It's nothing made up. These are real people who suffer real pain.
I'm Ari Shapiro, The Anatomy of Innocence, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in about 20 minutes in our Public Affairs Hour, World Affairs and a panel discussion on the legality of presidential executive orders. That's coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Appalachian Trail. Joining me today, Dan Jaguer and Danny Moody. They are hikers who will be through hiking the Appalachian Trail this summer and sharing their experience along the way using our new Maine Public app. Daisy is also going with them. She is Danny's dog. Tony Barrett's also here. He's been instrumental in the conservation and maintenance of Maine's Appalachian Trail, and he thru-hiked the AT in 1999. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Bob on Facebook asks, what precautions should hikers take regarding ticks and possible Lyme disease?
Probably the biggest precaution is just make sure you're checking yourself. You know what I mean? If you're going through a patch of woods that looks like it might have some ticks in it, don't be afraid to stop and really kind of evaluate yourself, check your hair, especially now. You know, I got a buddy who I can have him, you know, just check behind my ears or someplace that I might not be able to see on my head or something like that would definitely be an advantage.
Yeah, and I'm definitely, like, I'm bringing my first aid kit along. So we have the, like, a tick spoon, so you take it off properly, not just ripping it off and perhaps leaving the head behind. And like he said, if you're going through an area that you think is going to be, could be high infested ticks, maybe put some pants on and tuck them into your socks so they can't get in there easy. And just take precautions and watch out. And
go ahead.
And you can use Perethrin, which is made for clothing. And commercially, you can find clothes that go under the label of like insect shield that are saturated with Perethrin to keep it ticks.
And I've actually coated my backpack in that. They say that's a good thing to do is spray down your backpack in it.
And this is good advice, not just for Appalachian Trail hikers, but for anybody who's going to spend some time outdoors. We're going to go to Orono and Audrey. Hi, Audrey. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a class of 08 through hiker, and I just had some advice for your dog, Daisy. When you're talking about making your dog carry food, maybe make your dog carry something that you don't mind getting wet, because if it's anything like my dog, it's going to roll and stuff, and even with waterproof stuff sacks and stuff, sometimes they loosen up, and, you know, dogs don't always like eating mushy food, so that's just my advice.
Thank you. I appreciate it, because the last time she had her pack on, we went for a walk, and she was rolling around in snowbanks.
Yeah. And probably going to go right through a river that you're going to carefully go over.
Stones. She'll bomb right through it.
Yeah. Audrey, thanks for your call. We have an email from Natalie. I'm a local Maine author who recently published a book about the Appalachian Mountain Club's White Mountain Professional Trail Crew. The book is called 100 Summers. It's a collection of stories that highlights the history, work, and adventures of the crew starting in 1919 through the present. Much of the work takes place on the Appalachian Trail in Maine and New Hampshire. So, let's see here. Natalie, if you're listening, go ahead and post some more information about your book on our Facebook page so people who are interested can see your name and see the title of it. We're going to go to David, who's calling from Pemaquid. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yes. This is a fascinating program. I spent some time hiking the Himalayas not too long ago, and I was intrigued with some of the ideas that the Sherpas gave me. I was alone with a guide or two. And I was intrigued by the recent one about pantyhose. They suggested that, but I also was told to wear, I went to Beans and got some silk underwear, the long silk underwear. And it prevented chafing, and it was magic. And the other one was women's socks. I got silk socks. The other one was the pair of boots. Obviously, you guys are going to go through multiple pairs of boots. And the best suggestion I had was to break into pair and not to carry them with you, but arrange to have them sent to various locations. And you can tell when your shoes are about to go. They can send you another pair, but have them pre-broken in and don't try to carry the extra set with you, because it's a real challenge, and also do whatever you can to bring straps to strap your ankles, because that's a, you may find going up and down the hills and on rocks, they're quick to go as well as your knees. So, for what it's worth.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you for everything. Great tips. We definitely have thought about the shoe thing. I think we both actually have two pairs that we have broken in, and I think we're considering getting, you know, one or two more pairs to be ready for the trail. But we have two already, both of us. I know that.
Have them ship them to you at locations.
No, yeah, exactly. That's the plan, to have us sent down and dropped off at one of the PO boxes, which are listed right online, and so you know, and then you just set it up so that the post office knows to hold it for an AT hiker.
Every ounce counts, right? So we're going to go. Thanks, David. We're going to go on to Kat, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Kat. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you might know, along the Appalachian Trail from Maine all the way down the trail to where it ends, are there any mountain areas that maintain their snow cap or half snow cap or maintain it during the summer months, either on the trail itself or alongside the trail itself?
When you get down towards, I mean, like Georgia and Tennessee, you'd think wouldn't have snow, but as you get up into the higher, because I mean, the highest location on the Appalachian Trail is Clingman's Dome at, you know, a little over 6,000 feet. You will encounter some snow down there. As of right now, I've been staying, there's a website you can go to. People post pictures and little journals. There is no snow down there, you know what I mean, unless they got some snow and maybe it put an inch or two on the ground. But other than that, there's no snow along the way.
Probably the most likely place is Katahdin, right?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, Kat, thanks a lot. We'll go to Jenny, who's calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Jenny, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I happen to be a major animal lover, and a concern I had was for Daisy. Are you going to put a tracker on her in case she gets spooks and takes off, sees a squirrel or something?
Yeah, she's actually already has one.
That have, okay, yeah, because I know that occasionally animals do get lost, and I got really concerned, so I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks, Jenny. We're going to go to Kathy calling from MDI. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. I thought I would just share a little anecdote myself. Last fall, I hiked Katahdin with my couple of my daughters and their boyfriends. And as we were heading up the mountain, there were several people coming down who had just finished. So they'd summited on the top of Katahdin and were coming down. And so we got to chat with, I think, three different people who had that experience. And their range of emotions was quite different. One was happy to have it done and shared, you know, what were his favorite parts and what was not so favorite. But one of them was just almost beside himself. It was the end of his trip. He didn't know what he was going to do with himself. He said, I just want to go sit on the picnic table at the bottom and cry. So just thought that was an interesting how different people respond differently to such an adventure and the end of it.
Do you remember, Tony, what your emotions were when you summited Mount Katahdin?
I was sad to see the trip end. Actually, I summited down in Springer. I did what was called an alternative hike.
Wow.
So I flip-flopped, and I started at Katahdin in August and then finished down in Springer in November. But, yeah, it's why so many people feel impassioned about this trail and why so many people want to give back, why we have so many volunteers who are working to maintain these trails, because it is very emotional and people get impassioned about the trail.
Kathy, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
And I've read, from what I've read and heard from most people, is a lot of time when you do finally get back and maybe you get home and you sit down finally and you realize, like, what do I do next? Like, every morning you're going to wake up and feel like you should be walking and you don't need to anymore. And that's like one of the big challenges you need to come over, and that's after the trail. That's not even during the trails going. That's once you finish that, you know, you need to overcome what you've gotten used to.
Kathy, thanks for calling. We'll go to Augusta and Ryan. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, I've heard that a couple fellas are going down the thru-hike, and in the summer of 2015, I followed a father and son. I'm a filmmaker in Maine. I followed a father and son from Booth Bay Harbor as they did a thru-hike, and I made a documentary film about the whole ordeal. I followed them throughout the trail for about 450 miles. With all my camera gear, and I learned a lot about the culture in itself. I learned that I couldn't do the whole thing in its entirety, but I equipped them with GoPros, and the stories that came out of it, the serendipity that came out of it, it was an amazing experience. And I wanted to wish you guys luck, and I wanted you, in case you hadn't seen it, the film is called Walking Home. It's on YouTube right now, and it really opened my eyes to what's out there on the trail. So just wanted to say that. The second part, I released the film in two parts, and the second part's going to premiere in Booth Bay next month. Not to make this a shameless promotion about me, but I wanted to wish you two luck, because and my only advice I would say for you guys is don't go in there with any expectations at all, you know? Just go in there open-minded, because it's going to change. It's going to change you, and it changes everybody. So,
Ryan, I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, if you could go to Maine Calling's Facebook page and link your film. I'm sure some of our listeners would love to see that. It's just facebook.com/MaineCalling. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Thanks, Ryan. We were talking during the break, Tony, and you mentioned that we're seeing a spike in interest in the Appalachian Trail again. Why do you think that is, and how many more people are we seeing now than we were, say, a decade ago?
Yeah, 2016 set an all-time record. It was 25% more than 2015. And I just got word as of March 22nd, 2,000 hikers have registered and have started in Georgia, which for this same date is 20% higher than last year. So if that proceeds, Danny and Dan are going to have some company, and we may set another record this year.
How? Why do you think? Why do you think now? Is it just because there are so many millennials out there?
Someone asked me recently, like, have you seen the two movies that just came out about the Appalachian Trail? And I'm like, no, I haven't seen those. And then I was like, that's probably exactly why. I mean, people will probably watch this movie, get going. But the amount of people that start and the amount of people that actually get out there, do the trail and go, all right, this isn't the same as the movie, and then they head home, you know what I mean, it's probably a pretty big number as well.
Yeah, and I don't mean to scare off people. There's plenty of space out there to have a good wilderness experience and hike in solitude. So.
Okay. Well, and I think that a few years ago, Bill Bryson had his book, A Walk in the Woods, but I don't think that would probably spur a lot of people because he didn't make it very far. We're going to go to Presque Isle and Todd. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My comment is that I've hiked a number of national scenic trails, including the AT, but having a dog makes the journey a much more difficult because you can't take them through national parks. If the dog's injured, you're injured more or less. You know, if you stay in a shelter, there's a lot of people object to dogs around the shelter. And so it's something you might consider. I mean, you're going to take it, but it is you may be kind of an outcast to some people who don't care for dogs.
Well, thanks, Todd. Have you thought about this, Danny?
Yeah, luckily I've had plenty of time to think about it. I've had a couple family members already tell me, you know, if at any point she gets injured and you don't think she can continue, you just let me know. I'm going to drive down and I'll pick her up. And then obviously through the Smoky Mountains, I can't bring her. So I actually have a boarding service set up that with transportation. They bring her. They pick her up at Fontana Dam, drop her off at the other end of the Smokies, and then she's good until we get to Baxter, which is, you know, that's a breeze. I can just have somebody from the family come grab her. But those are all things that I actually have thought about. You know what I mean? It's a big factor bringing a dog. It's another person you have to care for.
All right, Todd, thanks so much for your call. And I want to wrap up just by asking you, Tony, if people are interested in learning more about the Appalachian Trail, other than going to your website, what would you recommend?
Attend the conference that we're going to be having at Waterville Colby College, August 4th through 11th. This Maine Appalachian Trail Conference is considered to be the largest hiking conference in North America. So there'll be a lot for listeners who want to learn about long-distance hiking. There'll be over 50 workshops, over 200 hikes, an exhibit and trade show. Come and get inspired about the Appalachian Trail this summer at Colby College.
All right, and we'll put that on our Facebook page as well. Thank you all for being here, and good luck to you, Dan and Danny. We can't wait to follow your journey and see how it goes. And we're going to say see you at Katahdin in the fall. Tony Barrett, two-term vice president of the Maine Appalachian Trail Club, and on its executive committee, Danny Moody and Dan Gugier are outdoor enthusiasts. They've been chosen to share their upcoming through hike on the Appalachian Trail using the Maine Public app. And they'll be joined on their journey by our special canine guest, Daisy. I think your name is misspelled on my piece of paper, Dan. It's Gugier, right?
Correct. Yes,
okay,
it is.
Okay, thanks.
And Dan and Danny, the club is going to be sending you a set of maps to take along with you so you can walk back to Maine well-guided.
Awesome. Thank you.
Terrific. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. The show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.